was real quick. Al, alcoholic.
I am.
Sobriety dates May 5th, 1987. And one thing you got to remember, what comes along with that is a belly button birthday, too. So I'm almost 53 years old. I came here when I was 27 and I stayed. Didn't have the intention to stay. Came here to save a job. And I stayed. Go figure. You know? Because I think the fellowship brings hope. And I believe if you go to enough meetings, you should be able to capture some of that hope. If you don't, you're probably in trouble, unfortunately. And that's what happened to me, is that you convinced me over a period of meetings that the life I was living wasn't any good anymore, and the life that you offered here would be 100 times better. And I believed you. And so I seized upon your suggestions, and I did them. I have never done them perfectly, but I have done them willingly. And I have fallen short of the mark probably on a daily basis. But I have been willing. And I have always been consistent in meetings. That's kind of the stabilizer for me. You know, all the rest is up for grabs from time to time. There's a part in the 10-step and the 12-and-12 that says, at the start of the 10-step, it says, can we stay sober? Yes. Can we live in emotional balance? And can we live under good purpose in all conditions? Yes. 2 out of 3 ain't bad. You know. And I love the 10-step and the 12-and-12. I just think that's a beauty. And the best time to read that is when you're having difficulty. It's a lot better read than when you're feeling good, you know. A lot of our literature is designed that way. When you're feeling really awful, pick it up. You know, it's like, you know, it just seizes you. But sometimes when you read and you feel good, it's still real good and interesting, but it doesn't hit you like it does when you're not feeling good. And I love reading the 10th, 11th, and 12th step in the 12-and-12 when I'm not feeling so hot. It's almost a booster for me. Throwing a meeting, sharing with my sponsor, and trying to help out somebody else, and asking God to help me and overcome my own self, it seems to work. And I do believe somewhere in that is the winning combination in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, can we live to good purpose under all conditions? And I think if we're applying that winning combination to our life, we can, you know, despite ourselves. Yeah. And the longer I stay sober, the more aware I am of my own defaults. Whether you want to call them shortcomings or character defects, I do believe they are probably my default position. And I think that the 10-step in the big book is pretty clear on that. It says selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And there's nothing in my life I have seen yet that hasn't grown out of that. Self-pity you can link to resentment and selfishness, and you can just link it all back to those four. And then Bill in the 12-and-12 really hit something when became clearer to me whether he meant it or not when he talked about the exact nature of our wrongs. It seems like self-centered fear has been the exact nature of my wrong, and it has boosted out the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And without God's help and yours, good sponsorship, being active here in this community, trying to help out other people, I believe I would have ate my lunch a long time ago and spit it out. I told somebody that, and I think they're a little bit shocked. I said, if I didn't have a buffer between me and reality without a drink, I'd probably be in a mental institution after about 6 months. And they're like, huh? You know, haven't you grown more than that? Yeah, I'm more aware of myself. And I'm not in a mental institution. In fact, if you looked at the outside of my life, you'd be going, oh, my God, isn't that incredible? You know, because the outside of my life looks really good. But on the inside, there's still unmanageability in my life, in my head. And I've never been totally absent of conflict. I've just learned how to react to them better. And one thing that the 10-step talks about is that it brings out that word that has been so important to me in the last couple of years. It talks about self-restraint, you know, is that I don't have to blow a fuse in front of you. I don't have to straighten you out if I disagree with you. If you say something to me that I don't like, I don't have to get in the contest and prove myself. Sometimes it's a challenge, and it bothers me, but I keep my mouth shut. And I believe that tolerance and restraint of tongue, pen, text messaging, email, bright lights, horn, and middle finger will keep me out of a lot of trouble. And in my sobriety, I have been guilty of all of those. And that's the nice thing about here, and one thing that is said in our literature that I really like is nothing is wasted in God's economy. You know, that all the things that we do can be of value if we correct them and we move forward. Sometimes it's very grudgingly. Billy and I were talking, some people talk about having a bad hair day or a week or a month. Mine have come in years sometimes, you know, of just going through stuff again and again until I can surrender to the fact that I've got to change, you know, that I don't like the change. I got a lot of change happening right now in my life and my business and the way we used to do things. We don't do it anymore. And, you know, my partners are getting older and they're thinking about leaving. And I found out again that I need change in my life, but I don't embrace it when it first happens. In fact, I don't really like it. I start getting resentful towards it. And at the same time, I know that I need it, you know. Because change is, when it's all said and done and I look back, I always see that's just the thing that I needed. And I know that intellectually, but I don't always go through it initially that way. I don't embrace it the way I should. But every change that I've had in sobriety has helped me out tremendously. And Bill was on to something when he said pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress, you know. And I believe that's true, you know. I wish it was, because I was walking around happy and I got it all together and I've got Alcoholics Anonymous on an intellectual level. I'm well read in these books, you know. I can recite to you Alcoholics Anonymous back and forth. But that doesn't seem to be the thing that does the trick. It's being frustrated sometimes. It's being resentful. It's going through stuff. It's being full of fear and moving forward slowly sometimes, believing that there is a God. And for me, that the whole God concept comes very much alive in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And I wouldn't want to live life. I've told people before, they said, do you believe in God? And I said, yeah. And I said, I can tell you one other thing that I know for sure. I'd rather live life with God than without God, and I can't tell you anything else about it. You know, and if you want to find more, there's some written in the literature. You might ask somebody else a little bit more read than I am on that subject. But I'd much rather live in this life with God than without, because I lived without God. And it wasn't very. In fact, it was enough to bring me here. And you know, the interesting thing about that is I did believe in God, and that was the extent of it. I couldn't get out of the county jail. So when people say all you have to do is believe in God, I already did. I couldn't get out of the county jail. I had to do something more than that. And I believe that step three on offers me a little bit more than that. You know. Well, I am an alcoholic. And for some reason, and they're always studying us, I can't drink normally like other people. That I have a different reaction to alcohol. When I stop drinking, and I can stop drinking from time to time, the unfortunate thing is I can't stay stopped. And as the time goes on in the progression, I can't tell you when that's going to be. It could be in the next hour, it could be the next month, it could be 3 weeks later, but for me it was usually a daily drinker. And once I start drinking, I lose all control of the consumption of alcohol, you know. And behind that, when I'm sober, I'm a nervous person because I'm irritable, restless, and discontented. I'm short on temper. I don't feel very good over a period of time. Everything gets to me. Lots of things bother me. Ties me up in knots. And then I drink again, and I don't even know I'm drinking for that reason. I'm just drinking because I want to go back to the bar and get drunk tonight, tell you the truth. I don't think that's because I'm emotionally upset. I mean, in AA, I certainly learned that. Maybe there was something behind that. But, you know, we get into this kind of scientific approach as your triggers. Well, I got to tell you one thing. The big book never talks about a trigger. It talks about insanity. And so the only trigger for an alcoholic like me is insanity of the first drink, you know. Other than that, it's just kind of an intellectual exercise. And it will not help me to stay sober. But understanding for me the insanity of the big book was very, very important. That I did have that. the insanity of the first drink that I would drink again no matter what. And I would drink after a lot of trouble, and I would drink when there wasn't any trouble. Because what would pop in my mind is a drink, and I'd go ahead and drink. And sometimes it's easy to get confused here with insanity being a psychiatric illness, though a lot of us could probably raise our hand and be good candidates for a mental institution when we were drinking and maybe sometimes sober. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the insanity of the first drink. And we're talking about getting in a position through the steps and the fellowship and everything AA has to offer and its suggestions that we're put in a position that we won't drink even if we want to because we've been restored to sanity. And that's a promise of the second step. And I have to get into that position or a guy like me is going to drink again. And I prove that time and time again in my history. You know, I'm 13 years old of a kid that already had a lot of problems. My father was very success-oriented and eluded me. My house was chaotic. It was full of drinking. I was a chaotic kid. The whole house was chaotic, you know. And I was sitting down in southern Maryland, down by the beach on a, must have been a summer day as far as I remember. It certainly wasn't cold. We had shorts on and T-shirts. Had to be in the summer. And we'd gone to the back of the bar where the winos were, or the liquor store, actually in Maryland. I'm not sure there was a bar up front, but a lot of them had bars. And we bought two bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I got a hold of one of those, and to show off, I drank a whole bunch. In fact, I drank more than I should have drank. And something hit me, and it felt good, you know. And I think that Boone's Farm is still around, and I haven't looked in the liquor cabinets or in the beer cabinets in the stores for a long time. They should have a warning on the inside as you're drinking down, right on a white label on the inside. So, warning, if you're 13 years old, and drink a whole bottle of Boone's Farm, you may be a future candidate of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's something with 13 and Boone's Farm that seems pretty popular around here. You know, and I didn't go looking for a drink after that. We were child of the late 60s, the early 70s still were the late 60s, and we smoked non-habit-forming marijuana all the time. You know? And, you know, the next time I got drunk, I got in trouble too. It could have been 6 months later. Could have been a year and a half later. I really don't have the timeline in my mind anymore. In fact, I believe my memory has seen its best days. I really do believe that, you know. One of my friends says, well, Al, you don't have to worry about Alzheimer's. You're too self-obsessed. That's some of your own problem with your memory. You know, and sometimes in AA we talk about insanity being the self-obsession too, and I think in AA it's been separated pretty good for me, is that insanity still holds true to the insanity of the first drink. The rest is self-obsession. And I've certainly been a candidate of self-obsession here. There's no question. And so my parents thought I had a problem by the time I was 16 years old. They sent me over to a psychologist, and he meant well. Like most that I know today, they're well-meaning people and they want to help. And I got diagnosed with an emotional illness, and I didn't know until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I suffered from a spiritual illness. And that if the emotions of my life and the problems I had with my emotions were only a symptom of a greater problem, and the problem would be a spiritual problem. And if I could see that in Alcoholics Anonymous and capture that idea and apply the steps, what would happen is that the emotional problem would get a lot better. Because, see, if you treat a symptom, it never gets better, ever. In fact, it increases the problem. And when you get to the problem, which is selfishness and self-centeredness, and you start to treat that, the symptoms of that problem start to get better. And, boy, I got that in AA. It took me a while. I was here several years before I got that concept. But when I got it, I've held on to it ever since because it's made an awful lot of sense to me. So today, when I'm on the emotional roller coaster, I up the meetings, I call the sponsor, I reach out to more people, try to get some folks to go through the steps, you know, whatever it takes, ask God to help me with it. And I tell you what, there hasn't been a problem yet that has not responded to those actions since I've been here. And I've been here long enough to know that that works. And we're not talking about a year, 2 years, or 5 years. 25 years I've been doing that. It works really well. And so I got misdiagnosed, and shortly after that, because of the non-habit-forming marijuana problem and some of the other drugs of the 60s, and some drinking, and when I drank, I did get drunk. I was sent away and to a wilderness program, and you know, there I was treated for an emotional problem. Within the structure, I got better, and by the time I left, I'd had a GED. I was a high school dropout. I had no career orientation in my mind at all, even though my father had pumped a lot inside of me. I just, you know, my future just did not look bright, and now it did. So this experience that I had in this wilderness program for 2 years really did change my life, but it did not treat my alcoholism. Because I was treated on emotional problem, the emotions did get better within the structure, but when I left, in 6 months, I had 2 drunk driving charges. And after that, I had more. By the time that I finished drinking, I'd been arrested 11 times. And every time I got drunk, I didn't get in trouble. But every time I was in trouble, I was drunk or under the influence of something. It's funny, since I've been sober, I haven't had handcuffs behind my back. Go figure. You know? In college, my alcoholism went from 0 to 100. The progression took hold to where alcohol, by the fifth year of college, you're supposed to get out in 4, alcohol had taken the place, the only place it knows in an alcoholic's life, and that's number one. And that does, no matter how much you care about your kids or your education or your marriage or whatever it is in your life, alcohol will take number one. And it took number one. And it was devastating, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. This was in 1982. I took the steps to the fifth step, and I stopped because there was a gnawing feeling inside of me. Sitting in those meetings, though I liked AA, and I went to about a meeting on a daily basis for about 6 months, there was a disconnect between me thinking I was really powerless over alcohol, that my life was unmanageable. I just didn't connect with you because I just didn't think I was there yet. I mean, I knew that I had a problem with it, but I did not think it was that severe yet. So you know the story. I got drunk. And for the next 5 years, somewhere in the next 5 years of drinking to 1987, the lights turned out. You know, there's no more getting up, dusting my britches off and saying, okay, I'm going to get a new job, I'm going to cut down this time, slack off, or whatever I'd come up in my mind, some delusional type of thinking. And the insanity of the first drink always won out again. My parents begged me to stop, and the insanity of the first drink wore them out. The jobs that I had, the insanity of the first drink wore them out. Because once I put alcohol in me, it's not first drink anymore. I drink till I pass out. And I drank to a place that Bill Wilson became very familiar with, and I became very familiar with, and that was oblivion. And when you're an oblivion drinker like me, it's hard to be successful in life. The hangovers are brutal. You know, I'm a guy that suffered tremendously from hangovers. Some people say they never felt them here. I did. They were serious, and I did not have the motivation or energy anymore to be educated or to work or to play sports like I used to, or football, or basketball, or nothing. You know, I had to shake off the drunk all day long, get some food in me, hide it at work the best I could, try to get some water in me without throwing up because I was dehydrated, and then by 5 or 6, 7 o'clock at night, if I could and got off work that early, I drank again. Even telling myself during the day I'd lay off tonight, you know. And it was brutal. I personally don't care ever to go back there again. I don't think I have it in me. I don't think I would live very long. I think it would cripple me pretty quick. I'm going to keep my seat here. I am. You know, whatever it takes. And when I was 15 years sober, I moved from 4 meetings a week to 5 to 7 meetings a week. And that's my prerogative because I watched too many casualties with length of sobriety start leaving here. And I wasn't. I just upped it because one thing that you guys taught me, that AA certainly is a living program. None of us are going to question that. In fact, we say we have a design for living that really works. But if you want to keep your seat here, I think it's got to become a giving program. And I've got to find a way to give myself unconditionally and especially when it's really, really inconvenient. I've got to give myself here. When I feel like doing it, it counts. But when I don't feel like doing it, it counts a lot more. You know, and I did not feel like dressed. I'll tell you what happened before I got here. This has been a 100-mile-a-minute weekend. And I don't know about you, but when I first came here, I had some worries and doubts that I might be bored. Okay? Let me tell you what. If you dive in here head first and give yourself, you want the very best of Alcoholics Anonymous, give yourself the very best. Give it the very best you got. And I will promise you, you will wish for more moments of boredom. I promise you. You will greet them openly. So we've been going 100 miles a minute all weekend. Jake, my 4-year-old, he got baptized this morning, and I had a fifth step at 8 a.m. And after that, I went mountain biking, and I'm out in the woods. And before I went, my front tire was flat, so I used my spare, and I didn't put another one in there because I never get two flats in a row. Well, you know what happened. I went down the hill, hit a rock, and I heard it. And I'm a mile, and it's like about 4 o'clock, and I'm like, oh, God, I hate to call Billy and tell him I'm stuck out in the woods here. I got to. So I jogged all the way home. I haven't jogged in a long time. And I got home, and it was only 4:15. That's the problem. My whole sobriety is my perception. You know, that's why I need a clock, a GPS, and a sponsor. You know, I get way off track. And, you know, those things helped me get perspective. And I needed perspective, so I looked at the clock, and I found that I wasn't in any rush. It was 4:15, and had plenty of time. So and when I got home, I said, God, it'd be nice to take a nap. And I said, no, I got a speaking engagement, and I got to go there. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is motivation is what gets you started here. In your first year or two, you're real motivated all the time, at least I was. But what keeps you here is habit. And that's why it's so important to go to regular meetings on a weekly basis. Because when the mind kicks in and you go, I don't feel like going, I'm tired tonight, got a good reason, you're there. And that's happened to me every time. I probably about, to the 5 or 7 meetings that I go to every week, I probably have talked myself out of at least half of them with good purpose on a weekly basis of why I really don't need to go tonight. I haven't missed any in a long time. Everybody will understand. I'm quite tired. Woke up early with the child, on and on and on, and I guarantee I'm there. And that's the beautiful thing of Alcoholics Anonymous is when the habit kicks into the commitment, you're there despite your thinking. Now, if you don't have the commitment and you don't have the habit, I tell you what happens to a lot of us. The thinking takes over. And if I'm just hitting meetings, hodgepodge here, there, everywhere, you know, I don't really have a solid commitment. I like this meeting, drive over there, bomb, bomb, bomb. You know what happens? And I've watched it to a lot of good meeting folks around here. They start talking themselves out of it. And one day they're down to barely any. And that's not a good place for me to be anyhow. The best place for me to be is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't trade it for the world. I just got too much going on in my head and my life not to have this as the basis. And I have to find time for Alcoholics Anonymous. I just have to. I find time for everything else. I got to fit this thing in. And when I fit this thing in, I find I have time for everything that I didn't have time for. I don't know if you've ever been in that position, but you've got 10 things going on. You know, I got to get the baby, got to run over here to the laundry, I got to go over to the dry cleaners. I need to go over to Whole Foods. I got to get this. I got to get that. Then I got to get home. I promise I'd be there. I'm going to cook dinner tonight. I possibly do not have time for a meeting today. Ain't going to hurt me. I've already been to 5 this week. I'm in the meeting. I spend 1 hour. I get a pause. And after the meeting, what I find out is I have time for all the things that I didn't think that I'd have time for. Now, if I skip the meeting, what happens is I don't have time for the things that... It's funny, you know. It's... The beautiful thing about spirituality is a lot of times it doesn't look logical. You know, you don't connect the dots until you have the experience of connecting the dots. You know, it's like somebody says, well, I have a divorce coming up, and boy, this is tough, and everything's going on, and all my money's going to go, and ah, blah, 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 go to more meetings. Huh? I mean, where's the dots to that? What? I need a head-on frontal assault of self-will. you know, I'm going to take me and put all my energy into this. I'm going to solve this. I'm going to straighten it out. I'm going to get the lawyers. I'm going to do this. I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to head on front of the assault of self-will. What happens in it? I get smashed until I can surrender enough and ask, God, your will, not mine, be done. Humbly, many times each day. And to go over to AA and sink in there, hook, line, and sinker, and to heck with that big problem that I need to solve. And what happens by seeking over here for a while, this problem starts getting solved. It don't look logical. You can't write a paper about it. What? I went to a whole bunch of meetings, tried to reach out, called my sponsor, asked God for help in this big, surmountable problem that I thought would never be solved. It got solved. And I put the minimum into it. You know, you scratch your head sometimes. But that's the beauty of AA. And if it didn't work that way, I'd be in a lot of trouble. Because I'd have a frontal assault on everything. Marriage, kid, you know, business. Self-will, just a frontal assault. Let's do it, baby. You know? And you know what? I never won in that. It looks good when you first start, you know, put your intellect, put some... Funny thing is... So I got here. Now, I'll continue because, you know, I went from 0 to 100. Progression got me. I ended up May 5th, 1987 in AA. Didn't tend to stay here. Been here ever since. And the first thing that I had to do, and I knew I had to do, is I had to start making amends. And so I took the steps off the wall, and I had an off-the-wall program. And it worked just fine for where I needed to. I hadn't got into the directions of the big book. In fact, at that time, I was reading the big book as though it was a novel. And when you read the big book as a novel, it's good. You know, you jump to the back of the stories and, you know, a little bit of Bill's story, a little bit of this. Capture a little bit of the God concept. And we agnostics, you know, God doesn't make too hard of terms on us. I'm off the hook now. I picked up some of those things. And I read it as a novel. And then I put it on the shelf. And so, you know, I kind of had my program, and so did everybody else back then. There wasn't a clear direction of the steps through the big book or anything. And we didn't have the clarity that we have today in some of our groups, a set of directions to the steps. That makes sense. And so when I was about 18 months sober, I got an AA sponsor, and... We started getting into the book through Joe and Charlie and some other folks. And I had a 100% different experience by taking the directions out of the big book than I did from the steps off the wall. I created my own program. It was good enough to last me to get me to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had a... make these amends. I had a bunch of financial amends to make. I had amends all over. And I went ahead and I started making those amends after I'd taken those steps. I retook them with this sponsor, another fifth step. And the six and seven, I started to understand it wasn't about me working on myself, where before I think I was working on my character defects, the headlong frontal assault on my own problems. And they showed me in the big book that this is not really about your frontal assault on your problems. This is about a surrender process that will probably take the rest of your life. And that, you know, six and seven, if you read them, entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove your shortcomings, it doesn't talk to you about you removing your own. And so that's where the literature started becoming very important to me, is that because it gave me a degree of simplicity that I was lacking by just kind of gathering information in meetings and off the wall. It was a little bit more complicated than the book had made it. So that's why I fell in love with the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I started making these amends, and I went to my boss, and I told him that I had stole some money from the corporation, and that I'd been drunk a lot, which they knew because they had fired me, and they'd taken me back because I was getting sober. Anyhow, they were hoping I was getting sober. It took them a while to believe that. And I sat down with him and I asked him, you know, I'm going to pay it back. And he says, well, you could do that. And he said, it wasn't that much money anyhow. It was only a couple $100. He said, what I'd like you to do, he says, you told me that in these amends that you had lied about your college degree, that you really didn't have one. And I said, no, I was one credit short, you know. And Frostburg ought to be shot for giving me a college degree, unless they had one and we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that my life would become unmanageable. That would have been, I probably could have got a master's in that. Well, I'm glad they gave me one. I got one on my wall, but I'm unscarred by education because I've learned more on the Discovery Channel and History Channel than I did in college. But, you know, and he said, I want you to go back to school. He said, in fact, the company will pay for it. So I signed up. I got my one class. It was 3 credits, one class, and I got that degree from Frostburg. I did that amends, and I went back. I started paying back the financial stuff to people. There was a lady that my mother drank with. Her name was Aggie, and she couldn't stand me because she gave me $5,000 to go to college, and I never intended to pay her back. And I had $5,000 debt out on her, and I had to go and make amends. And she was pretty mad, needed to be, and she wasn't sitting there saying, hey, this is great. She says, you know, I want my money. And pretty much she said, I don't like you anyhow. So I started paying her $50 a paycheck and moved it up to $100. And every time I got an advancement in the pay or I got a raise or something or a promotion, I always added more money to that. And so when I was just around 7 years sober, the owner of the program, who was pretty wealthy, came to me and said, how many outstandings do you have? I said, well, I'm paying $100 here, I'm paying $50 here. I said, I'm paying another $50 here, I'm paying another $100 here. He said, let's go to the bank. So I went to the bank with him and walked up, and he said, you're good for this, right? You're not going to rip me off? I said, no, I'm not going to rip you off, you know that. And he went to the bank, called the president out, and he said, he needs $7,000, I'll co-sign for him. And he said, out of that $7,000, he said, you can pay everybody back, and then you can pay one payment to the bank every month. Because we added up, it was about $7,000 that I owed. And he did that for me, and I never went delinquent. And I paid every amend back that I owed, and by the time I was about 11 or 12 years sober, I was totally out of debt, financial debt. I didn't know anybody. I'd had money problems. I'd spent more money than I made. You know, I had a lot of problems around money. I was immature with it. I was handling it like a five-year-old, and I had to learn the hard way about money. You know, it didn't grow on trees, and my dad tried to tell me that. And the two guys that fired me at 11 years of sobriety, I went to them and I said, would you like to start a company? Because the owner that took me to the bank, he had sold. He wanted to retire, and they sold it to a company that really wasn't running it the way that it should. And they did go out of business in 10 years. Thank God that we stepped out of that, saw that coming. And I asked them, would you like to go in business with me? And they said, yes. And that's credit to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm just a drunk. You know, they didn't trust me. They didn't even want me there. They said, yeah. And we've been in business ever since. And, you know, business and partnerships, there's a lot of disagreements. You better have a lot of steps and a lot of meetings under your belt so the resentments don't eat you for lunch. You know, but what you do is you get closer to people, too. It's not just about that. And you learn not to react to them. And I've learned a lot of things in the last 10 years that maybe I didn't gather in the first 15 years, is that the overreactions to people or the trying to be right or prove your point, it just never works, you know. And you just end up in a fit in your head, and you go home with it, and then you have to go make amends. And a lot in the last few years, it's been a lot of amend making, you know, of people that I got into a contest with, or maybe somebody I said something poorly to when I didn't feel good, or some people I sponsored that I probably didn't let them off the hook right, and I didn't feel good about that. And there's one guy, I went and made amends to him. And sometimes I got to tell you, when I do this, I still think I'm right, you know, that I got it right. I got a justifiable resentment here, because all of mine are justifiable, and I think I'm right. But I go anyhow. I take the actions despite how I feel. So I went to him, and I asked him what I needed to do to correct it, and he told me, you need to make amends to my wife. Shouldn't ask that question, you know. And he said, you know, she's real angry, and she doesn't like you, and she's angry at everybody anyhow, because she hadn't been to AA in 15 years, and she's about ready to kill everybody. And I said, well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. So I told her whatever the difficulty was a long time ago, and I remember that night they were at our convention, and I kind of chewed him out about something, and she was there, and she was upset. So I added up what the hotel room would be, what the gas would be, added some interest, and I put the check in the mail, and I sent her a letter, and I said, you know, this is amends for my temperament down there. It was not good. I said, if I owe you more money, let me know, and if you'd like me to come up eyeball to eyeball to Washington, D.C., I would be glad to do that. I said, this is a preliminary here. I know not to lead with my chin. The big book talks about that. We don't have to go in and get punched. Okay, so I wrote a nice note. Never have got a letter back, but one thing is the check got cashed. Amends made, you know. And from that day on to that day, I had no worry in my mind anymore. I went up against another guy, and I knew I was right again. And I was thinking about how to solve this problem, you know, we both had a temper tantrum on each other. And it was one of my partners, and it was kind of nasty, and we had never had that before. We started in a disagreement and ended up in a volcano. And I'm thinking about, in about 3 days, you know, I'm angry and I'm resentful, and I got it up in my head, and I'm like, oh, I know how to solve this. It came to me, intuitive thought. I was going to meeting after meeting. I just need to go admit I'm wrong. He don't have to say nothing. Who cares what he said to me? Where did I get that from? Of course I care what you said to me. I didn't care no more. I sat down in the office. It was Monday morning. I said, look, I'm wrong. I said, how do I make this right? I just did what you guys told me to do. I've done it a lot. And he goes, I'm sorry too. He said, I didn't quite understand it. And I said, yeah, me either. I said, it got a life of its own. It didn't even start there. It was just a simple disagreement. And ended up in, I'm glad they didn't have that on videotape for either one of us. And after that, we've been no conflict. You know, and somebody the other day said, hey, I got a conflict in a personal relationship. I've said some things. I said, look, I'll cut to the chase. There's only one way to solve that. And they don't have to change one thing. You got to go and admit you're wrong. He goes, I should have thought of that. He goes, really? I'm like, yeah. And I said, when you go admit that you're wrong, the conflict will leave your mind. That's the beauty of this thing. You know, God inspired, no question. And there's some inspired people here, too. I listen to them. And I listen to some uninspired people, too, and I get some things from them. Sometimes just what not to do. You know, I'm a good listener in AA meeting. I changed all my whole thing. You know, I used to be, you know, if the meeting wasn't into the big book, it didn't run the way that I thought it should run, you know, I would badmouth the meeting, or I would kind of talk down or try to straighten them out with my education of the big book to try to help them because they were off the base. And I found myself walking out of meetings a lot alone, you know. And though some people say that helped them, I never felt right in that position. And I changed. And from that point on to today, and it's been quite a number of years, I haven't sat in a bad meeting. And the only thing that's changed is my attitude. Because the one thing that I found is I'm not here in AA to straighten anybody out, and I thought that I was. I'm only here to carry the message. And every meeting, when you sit in and you know that your role is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, it can't be a bad meeting. But if I'm there with my judgments machine running and don't think they started on time or they didn't do it right or they didn't read the right things or this person's off on the third step or what that, well, that's not the position I want to be in anymore. I have one purpose in an AA meeting, that's to carry the message. I'm not perfect. Here's the message. And that's it. And every meeting I've walked out of since then, and that's been a number of years, I've walked out with people. It's funny. Whether it's in Morgantown, West Virginia, where I was last week, you know, or Hagerstown, Maryland, where I was Friday night, I walk out. You know, hey, I remember you. Glad you're back here. You from UVA? Oh, Charlottesville area. Oh, yeah, used to be. I had a guy in Southern Maryland one time. He came up to me and he goes, you really changed. He goes, I hated you. He said, you made me feel bad about myself. He says, I want to give you a hug. I said, I've become a teddy bear. And he came up and hugged me. And he goes, I'm glad you changed. It means I can change. I said, yeah, we can all change. That's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have to stay in one position. You know, we can change. That's the beauty here. You know, it's never too late to change. I just got to open my mind up and probably have another surrender. You know what surrender feels like? Oh, God, not again. I want to be happy, joyous, and free. No, that's the breather between the rounds of life. It's not the objective here. It's the breather. We all need a breather. Then we go back in it. And now, when I was 20, this was an interesting thing. My wife wanted to have a baby, and we kind of didn't see eye to eye on that one. And it ended up in a long, drawn-out, two and a half year fight, separation. And there was more to it than the baby. The baby was kind of a centerpiece, but there was a lot of stuff. And the main stuff was me, you know, is that my behavior, my mannerisms, my reactions were not that good. We were having financial problems. I'd made some poor decisions about building a house. We'd lost a lot of our retirement money, and I took it out. And the baby thing was there, and I didn't want to, you know, I was too old for a baby. And like my sponsor reminded me, no, you're too self-centered. And he's probably more right there than anything, is that you're too self-centered. And he said, you know what, as you get older, you need to have something so you're less self-centered to have a kid. Okay. Thank you for sponsorship. And so we started the process, and I wasn't into it. I not had the right attitude. And the doctors told me that my body didn't manufacture what it needed anyhow, and so there was little hope for the having a pregnancy. And my wife asked me, would I do all the fertilization? I said, no, I'm not. I just can't do all that. I'm sorry. I don't want all that stuff in my body. And so we had disagreements, and she was unhappy about it and discouraged. And we finally said, okay, we both surrendered to the fact that we weren't going to have kids. And guess what happened? There it was. She came to me. And I want to tell you guys, I was not a happy camper that day. I saw my life going down the tubes, all my plans for the West and mountain biking and all the things I had planned, you know, and all the freedoms that I'd have now that I was in my 50s and 60s and I didn't have to work to the bone anymore and I actually had money to save and we could go to Canada and we could go kayaking here and maybe even a Europe trip. And what did you do to me? Oh, God! And so I have a set of friends, not just a sponsor, but I have a set of friends that have all been through reactions and anger and everything, and it was awesome. You know, they settled me down. And Al, you may not feel like it, but why don't you act like that is a good occasion for your wife and celebrate that? And I'm telling you, that was a real challenge for me because I was full of self-pity. And so, as time went on, for me it's taken time. I like what we hear here is that this is sobriety. It takes a while for me to catch up to the actions, even though I'm taking them, but in my mind, for the change to take place. And somewhere around 6 months of that pregnancy, I started to accept it and started to embrace it. And being a little bit, I'm not telling you that I was a big ass, but I can be an ass. And so when that baby came out of my wife and they had a C-section, it looked like a little pill. Thank you. I told you my mind has seen it's about that big, and he was totally white, and I was like, man, that's incredible. That. And I'm not saying that I haven't had some moments of trying of, oh my God, what did I possibly do? But I got to tell you, boy, that's a fantastic thing to happen in somebody's life, and I would have missed it because I'm self-centered, you know. And I've often said that, you know, if you want one thing to sum up my sobriety, if there was a neon light on my head flashing, it would say I'm wrong. You know, if I have one tailspin in my sobriety, it's I'm wrong. And being able to admit that is the freedom from bondage of self. That is the freedom. And if you look at the steps from step three on, or maybe all of the steps, it certainly is talking about admitting that I'm wrong and that myself is too much for me. One thing that you had impressed upon me is that a sick mind is not a solution to a sick mind. I cannot come over self by my own self. And I want to thank you for that. I'm going to have a plug-in to this power greater than myself, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my plug-in. You know, that's my way to this awareness of a higher power. Is the more meetings I go to, talking to my sponsor, reaching out, going back through the steps with myself or with the guys that I sponsor, there's always a connection to that. And if we look back in our history, we can see that God, in His infinite wisdom, did not give this message to our friends in the medical profession. Though He could have, they were sitting there. Silkworth was a beauty. He did not give it to our friends in the psychological community. And in the book, Carl Jung throws up in his hands and says, "I'm sorry, I misdiagnosed you. You don't suffer from an emotional illness," and it's not written like that. "You suffer from a spiritual illness." And there are documentations of this happening throughout history, and I don't know how to bring this about, smart man. But He allowed them to help us. He could have given this to our friends in the pulpit. They were certainly there. We plagiarized quite a bit, but we put it in alcoholic language so we could understand it. He could have done that. He certainly allowed them to help us, the Oxford group and all those folks. But God, in His infinite wisdom, gave this message to a broken-down stock speculator named Bill Wilson, who was not learned in any of those things. And He gave it to a doctor. Isn't that awesome? A proctologist. He was washed up. Okay? The neat thing about Dr. Bob, he was grabbing hold of the religious idea out of the Oxford group, and he had the medicine intellect, but he couldn't stay sober. That's awesome. And what they found out was in the union of one alcoholic trying to help another alcoholic to get sober, they were able to stay sober. That's why the spark in Akron was created. And the spark starts a fire. And you know what the fire here is? Enthusiasm. You know? It's not the dreadful, "Oh my God, I've got to go to another one of those meetings where I know what they're going to say. And I'm tired of hearing about the steps and the traditions." But enthusiasm. And knowledge here is good. I like some of it. But it's not contagious. Intellect is not contagious. Enthusiasm, which Bill called language of the heart, is contagious. And when we're talking about in the sense of enthusiasm of Alcoholics Anonymous, that starts that spark again. You know? Is that we get enthusiastic about this way of life. And I think there's a great description in our big book, and we read it every meeting, most meetings. Some of ours we read them, some of ours we don't, but most meetings read how it works, page 58 to page 60. And there's a certain little thing in that first paragraph under "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path," and we know a path is created by steps. That's the aim of the book. It's a basic text on it. It says we have to completely give ourselves to this simple program. That's the admission price into Alcoholics Anonymous. Completely. No strings attached. Completely. What a great description of surrender. And it talks about people that will not or cannot. And we see that. And we don't know who is, because you could never know a cannot from. But I know most of us, when we were new, we were haunted by the idea, are we really constitutionally incapable? And we have certainly have thought some people might be, but we do not know if they're will nots. We don't know that. You know? That's a hard case to draw. You know, are they constitutionally incapable? I would not know. But I do know that I'm not. Okay? Because I was able to take the rest of the steps. And I was able to have that personality change. And I was able to have the spiritual awakening. And I was able to have an experience that was sufficient to recover from alcoholism. When I say recovered from alcoholism, as the book uses, the insanity of the first drink has vanished from my mind. All the rest is up for grabs. But I am not in a booze-fighting mode in my mind. I am not in conflict whether I will go out and drink tonight or not, or smoke some non-habit-forming marijuana. That has left me many years ago. I've had a release from the insanity. And I have gotten the promise of the second step. I would not drink even if I would. And there's been very, very few times in 25 years that have I even thought that I was close to a drink. But I can tell you one thing 100% is that I may have thought about drinking in the last 25 years. I have dreamed about drinking. People go, I had a dream last night. Oh, I said, you know why? They go, why? I said, because you're alcoholic. Non-alcoholics don't have drunk dreams. You know, we always think we're doing something wrong. But I can tell you one thing I haven't done. I haven't planned to take a drink since I joined you. Everything else just revolves and leaves. You know. And I've been released from the insanity of the first drink, thank God. And as long as I stay close to and active in a program and a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe I'm relieved from the insanity of the first drink. I want to thank you for having me. And we have Billy, 14 years, okay? And if you don't think Billy's changed in 14 years, you're wrong. Because I listened to him in the first 2 or 3 years. Before we had cell phones. He's calling again. And Billy has become an active and giving member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's proof in the pudding that our life gets better despite us. And I believe that that's the basis of AA sometimes. That I don't know, my life gets better. God's good, despite all my imperfections. And I've enjoyed sponsoring Billy in the last number of years, you know, because the change took place. And the debate and arguing stopped. And the listening started. And I found out in sponsorship, when I stopped the debating and arguing and I start to listen, and I start saying, hey, what do you think I need to do? Things get better. As long as I'm debating and arguing and trying to be right, I'm not in the right position. And with that, Billy, thank you for asking me.